It is Friday, November the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, angst over what's next for the Islamic State after the France attacks.
There's a concern it goes beyond Paris, beyond France, because the key brains behind the operation was Belgium, and that the Molenbeek district of Brussels is an area of concern, as it's been so much in the past. So maybe Brussels could be next, but Germany is open, so is the UK.
Also ahead, U.S. national security plus trophy hunting. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. While Abdelhamid Sabiyad, the leader of the Paris attacks, has been confirmed dead, the manhunt continues for at least one suspected terrorist on the run since last Friday. French officials admit they do not know where Salah Abdeslam is, but the search for him is intensifying across France and Belgium. It did so on Thursday, also spread to the Netherlands. French Prime Minister Manuel Valls Thursday urged French lawmakers to extend a state of emergency imposed by President François Hollande in the wake of last week's attacks that killed 129. Meanwhile, France and Russia are preparing separate draft resolutions to be considered as early as next week in the UN Security Council to unite the international community in the fight against the Islamic State. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told an audience in Washington there is a struggle now for the future of civilization.
This is a moment, a generational moment perhaps, but it's a moment in history where we have to, all of us, collectively stand up and say, no, we're not going to accept this, but also we're not going to be intimidated by it. We're not going to be somehow cowed in our pursuit of daily life and of the values which drive us as a country and as people, as human beings. We've worked too hard and too long. After two world wars and through the Cold War and the creation of the United Nations and all that comes with it, and all of our efforts to try to carry values and interests that talk about resolving things through rule of law and living peacefully together, notwithstanding differences, and promoting tolerance. Tolerance, one of the most important words in life today, and one of the most important organizing principles of any decent society.
Terrorism expert Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University tells my colleague Victor Beatty, France was taken completely by surprise by last Friday's attacks because the Islamic State militants had gone off the digital grid in coordinating the attacks, but he says the French have quickly recovered.
It's embarrassing for them, and they were caught by surprise on Friday, but since the Friday attacks, they've had 400-plus raids and 60 arrests, 75 weapons seized, including not just Kalashnikovs, but also a rocket launcher. You know, they've really worked very hard these last few days and had good results. They were let down by not being forewarned by intelligence on Friday, and they have to figure out how that happened. But they've recovered very well. There are some worrying signs, of course. They still don't have any clarity about what they don't know, the unknown unknowns. They don't know how many other cells there are out there, what plans there might be for them to activate. Of course, there's a concern it goes beyond Paris, beyond France, because the key brains behind the operation was Belgium, and that the Molenbeek district of Brussels is an area of concern, as it's been so much in the past. So maybe Brussels could be next, but Germany is open, so is the UK. So there's a real sense of anxiety about that. The fact that that Syrian passport was found at one of the attack sites cannot be coincidental. I don't think a suicide bomber would accidentally take their passport into the field with them. I think it was done quite deliberately for us to find. I think that Islamic State wants to mess with the idea in European political thinking that migration is dangerous and it can't be controlled, and that amongst the refugees there will be terrorists. That's, of course, a very powerful nightmare to invoke, and we've seen its impact on the US already. It seems remarkable how quickly it's taken hold.
The scope of the Islamic State reach now beyond Iraq and Syria, the AP writes, and yet despite all the airstrikes over the past year plus, the Paris attack showed the group is now acting on global ambitions. It has withstood the aerial pounding by U.S. and coalition warplanes, defended its core territories, and apparently used its resiliency and social media savvy to replenish its ranks as quickly as they're reduced.
So far, all of that is true. I mean, it will let you know in hindsight where they're overreaching. They appear to be deliberately provoking anger, outrage. They're doing outrageous things to get us angry and outraged. But it appears that what they're trying to achieve from that is to encourage us into a long ground campaign. Now, I suppose you have to acknowledge that's not entirely foolish from their point of view, because long ground campaigns have been our undoing in Afghanistan and Iraq. But this may be an inflection point for them. If we can see a solution to the civil war in Syria through negotiation, and if we see a future Syrian government work with militia groups and the Syrian military to fight Islamic State on the ground in Syria, but Syrians taking back Syrian towns and cities, then this might be the point at which the tide turns against Islamic State. But they are conscious that this new wave of global directed attacks, mass casualty attacks, help strengthen or maintain their brand power and help keep the flow of recruits coming.
Greg Barton says the multinational air campaign against the Islamic State cannot succeed without a Peshmerga-style ground force, and none of the rival forces fighting in Syria is strong enough to prevail, leaving a political solution as the only way to bring the global Islamic State, the threat from them, to an end. Well, the fallout from the IS group's terror attacks in Paris has put the future of Europe's passport-free travel area, known as the Schengen Zone, in doubt. Several of the perpetrators were known to intelligence agencies but were not intercepted. European ministers are due to hold an emergency meeting today in Brussels to look at ways of improving security. That part of the story now from Henry Ridgewell.
Paris attackers were seemingly free to roam across Europe, coordinating the assault in France and Belgium. The continent's Schengen zone allows people to travel without passport checks across 26 countries. It is a cornerstone of the European Union, but its problems have been exposed, says border security specialist Callum Jeffrey of Britain's Royal United Services Institute.
I don't think we'll see the end of Schengen, but I think particularly in the next few months, you'll see countries quietly strengthening different aspects of their border security. I think it's too fundamental to the principles of the European Union to be abolished completely.
The Netherlands has proposed creating a so-called mini Schengen zone, excluding countries like Greece and Italy, where large numbers of undocumented migrants are arriving. But German Interior Minister Thomas de Maizière dismissed the plan Thursday. He said Europe's political aim must be to make the total Schengen area as functional as possible, saying it is about the better control of entry and exit of so-called Syrian fighters and Islamic State group supporters. One of the Paris suicide bombers, Ahmad al-Mohammed, appears to have posed as a refugee to travel from Syria to Greece via Turkey. The chief planner of the attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud, killed in a police raid in the Paris suburbs Wednesday, boasted on social media of his ability to slip in and out of Europe to the Islamic State group's heartland in Syria. France's Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve Thursday said Abaoud's movements had not been tracked.
Suggérant qu'il ait pu arriver en Europe et cheminer jusqu'à la France.
Cazeneuve said Abaoud must have gotten into Europe and then continued to France. It was only on November 16th, he said, after the Paris attacks, that an intelligence service from a non-European country signalled it had been aware of his presence in Greece. France has called on its European partners to urgently improve security and intelligence, warning the fate of the EU itself is at stake. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you can stay on top of the aftermath of the Paris attacks at our website, voanews.com. Still ahead on the program, what U.S. presidential contenders are saying about the Islamic State and U.S. national security. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has laid out her strategy for dealing with the threat posed by the Islamic State. She said the United States must lead, but Arab nations must do more militarily in the wake of the Paris terror attacks. Several other presidential contenders also have weighed in on national security in recent days, as we hear now from VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone.
The podium is yours.
Speaking Thursday in New York, Hillary Clinton said the United States needs to intensify its efforts against the Islamic State to defeat it.
That starts with a more effective coalition air campaign, with more allied planes, more strikes, and a broader target set.
Clinton favors additional U.S. special forces in Iraq and Syria, but opposes a large American troop presence. She also supports a no-fly zone. Clinton took issue with several Republican presidential contenders who want to bar Syrian refugees from coming to the United States.
Discriminating against Muslims, slamming the door on every Syrian refugee, that is just not who we are.
The tone was far different from Republican frontrunner Donald Trump during a rally in Massachusetts.
We have a president that doesn't have a clue. We have a president that says ISIS is contained. He's contained. The only thing contained is us. We're contained because we have no leadership.
The Paris attacks have refocused the presidential contenders on national security and what they would do to counter the Islamic State. Republican Jeb Bush says he would send additional U.S. ground troops into Iraq.
It starts by re-engaging in Iraq in a way that embeds our forces, rather than keeps them in safe zones, embeds our forces with the Iraqi military. It requires direct support of the Peshmerga military, a great fighting force, the Kurdish force, to be able to show that we have the back of the Kurds.
Another Republican contender, Ohio Governor John Kasich, also favors ground troops, but he was vague on how many.
I don't think that you can deal with ISIS by just looking the other way. And when people say, well, how many boots on the ground, or what should the force look like? You know, that's a case where the military and the civilian experts will make recommendations.
The prospect of ground troops adds many complications, says analyst Anthony Cordesman.
So the whole idea that you're just going into these theaters with U.S. ground troops as if you weren't intervening in countries on the edge of civil war or actively in it simply defies reality. So does the idea that you can instantly deploy ground forces.
Recent polls show Americans are more determined to confront the terrorists, but remain reluctant to send large numbers of ground troops into either Iraq or Syria. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
A law banning the controversial activity of trophy hunting continues to gain support in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The Animal Welfare and Wildlife Conservation Organization, Born Free USA, appeared at a recent hearing before the state Senate. The group testified in support of a bill to ban the possession, transport, import, export, processing, sale, or shipment of many of Africa's endangered species. Adam Roberts testified at that hearing. He is the CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He says New Jersey has an opportunity to be a leader on this issue. He also says the illegal trafficking of wildlife products is directly responsible for shocking declines in wildlife populations in recent years. Mr. Roberts spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the legislation to ban trophy hunting.
This week in New Jersey, there was a hearing concerning legislation to prohibit the importation into the state of some trophies, wildlife trophies, of some of the most endangered animals on the planet, including elephants and rhinos and big cats. And the legislation that was introduced by Senator Lesniak of New Jersey is intended to try and stop this sort of grotesque killing of wildlife overseas and the importation of trophies for sport. I think what we're finding more and more across the country is that not only is the federal government taking action to try and address this conservation and animal welfare issue, but individual states are doing so as well, and obviously that's something that Born Free applauds.
How will this bill be enforced?
The bill will be enforced at the state level, and basically if the bill is approved, then of course Born Free hopes it will be approved, and approved expeditiously, it will prevent trophy hunters from going overseas and killing any of these protected species, mostly the big five that I've mentioned previously, and importing them back into the state of New Jersey. And for some of these animals, it's very hard to import them already because they are protected under the international treaty known as the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. One has to get a permit for some of these species to come back into the country. But of course, if they can't come into New Jersey at all, then that's going to prevent them from being killed in the first place. And I'll just add, the reason why I say that I hope that this bill will be passed expeditiously is because we're starting to see evidence more and more of trophy hunters going overseas and trying to kill these species like lions as fast as they can under the fear that the animal is going to be protected under the Endangered Species Act, and then that opportunity may soon be lost.
These pro-hunting groups argue that trophy hunting brings conservation funding into countries through fees for hunting permits. So how much money are countries actually making through these hunting permits?
It's a common ploy of the trophy hunting industry to suggest that somehow engaging in this slaughter en masse across Africa or anywhere in the world is going to generate revenue for local economies. Born Free's research shows that not only is it not generating revenue, in fact, only 1.8% of tourism revenue in Africa actually comes from trophy hunting revenue. Most of it, more than 98%, is coming from other forms of tourism, ecotourism, driving through the South African wine country, etc. So really, that's just a complete ploy, a PR stunt by the industry. But moreover, even that 1.8%, the money that does actually get generated from trophy hunting revenue, is not necessarily trickling down to the local communities. Many of these hunting operations are foreign-owned, and so the money is kept overseas, and the other folks on the ground are actually not seeing the financial and economic benefits. So we advocate strongly for ecotourism and non-consumptive wildlife tourism as ways to protect wildlife for future generations, but also to support the local economies of the people who live near with that wildlife.
You pointed out that New Jersey has the opportunity to be a leader on the issue of banning trophy hunting. Do you see other states taking up this issue as well?
What we've seen recently is that states all across the country are starting to take up the charge of looking at this issue. We just had a ballot initiative pass in Washington State that would prohibit the commercialization of a number of species, not just elephants for their ivory or rhinos for their horn, but also cheetah, pangolins, which are killed in the tens of thousands across the globe each year for their scales and their meat. So we're starting to see that happen all across the country now. And New York and New Jersey have done great work in terms of stopping the ivory trade. And as a result, California followed suit. So I think more and more we see that there's a groundswell of public support across the country for this kind of action. And if it's hard to do at the federal level, at least we can try at the state level where the citizens of these individual states care so deeply about protecting wildlife.
What is the next step in getting this bill passed?
Well, I think as a result of the hearing, there will be some amendments made to try and clarify some specific aspects of the bill. And then once that happens, it'll go back to the Senate for a vote, and then we'll hopefully get it through the legislature before the year is up, or at least early into the new year.
Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA, also Born Free Foundation. He was speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. Kim is host of the program Africa News Tonight. And it is time now to see what's trending online. International Edition's Giabby Lee is here with the latest on a Freddie Mac survey and how people are responding to it. Hey, G, so what's that survey telling us?
Hi there. Steve, the biggest takeaways are that 66% of the surveyed renters carry debt each month, and that 56% are optimistic about managing their debt. Another finding worth noting is that they're saving for other priorities, but not a down payment on a home, which used to be the biggest chunk of saving for many Americans. A lot of people are sharing the story online because this means a great American dream of owning a home is slowly dying. Actually, the idea that home ownership is the linchpin of the American dream has been slowly dying for the past couple of years.
I understand, G. So if people are not putting money aside for a down payment on a home, what are they saving for?
The number one priority seems to be saving for an emergency fund. Other priorities include saving for retirement and children's education. Saving for a down payment comes after that.
So I just got to know what's behind that trend.
Great question. Now, this is how Freddie Mac explained it. Rents are rising faster than incomes, and the latest data shows many renters don't have enough to pay all their debts each month, so they're forced to make trade-offs like cutting spending on other items. What worries me is that almost 60% of the surveyed renters are still optimistic about managing their finances, although they're carrying debt each month. And that goes to show how little people understand about the power of compound interest.
Then we might want to talk about the importance of it before you go, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's interest added to the principal of a deposit or loan. That means the longer people wait to pay off debt, the more it's going to cost them down the road. When it comes to saving, we love compound interest. When it comes to borrowing, we hate it. So anyone who has debt needs to get the debt monkey off their backs first before saving for anything. Steve?
Crazy monkey. Many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can check her out on Twitter. G is at G. Abby Lee. You can also find International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
80% of the people in the Democratic Republic of Congo do not have electricity. Kerosene lamps, candles, and fire huts are common sources of light. Entrepreneur Malanga Washikola, co-founder of Alltech, is trying to change that. His company distributes solar energy systems to off-grid and under-electrified households. When he first started, Washikola says his business was risky.
Because we distribute solar kits and products on credit, and we spread the payment over like 2 to 3 months.
Recently, Washikola spent time at the largest solar provider in the U.S., and his internship there helped him learn how to improve his company.
You know, it provides me with a lot of skills and knowledge that I can apply back home when I go back to my country.
Washikola's goal is to provide solar electricity for some 2 million locations in the DRC in the next 5 years. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, it turns out that country singer Chris Young has released a new CD. It's called I'm Coming Over, and the title track has reached number one on Billboard's Country Airplay chart. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that Young has made a career out of singing love songs and romantic ballads, some very good ones, but can still sing those rocking honky-tonk anthems as well.
I'm coming over.
Chris Young first came to the public eye as the winner of 2006's Nashville Star Talent Competition. His song Voices from his first EP entered the Billboard Top 40 at number 37. His first number one hit, Getting You Home, came from his second album, The Man I Want to Be. In all, the album produced 3 number one hits for Young. The singer would get 2 more number ones from his next album, Neon. Many of Chris Young's most successful songs deal with love, either finding it, saving it, or losing it. Chris says that he's not ashamed to admit that romance makes up a big part of his repertoire.
You know, I do have a range of songs and stuff that we sing about. There are some party songs and, you know, there's some sad songs, but even a lot of the sad songs are really just, you know, breakup songs. Like a lot of the themes that I deal with as a writer and as an artist really do kind of revolve around or come back to love at some point.
But who I am with you is who I really want to be. You're so good for me.
Young, who says he used to ride around in his truck as a teenager, listening not only to country, but also to the crooning of Boys to Men, says that recording love songs has brought him both male and female fans.
I think really for me, you know, I do sing a lot of love songs. I think guys and girls, everybody can relate to love songs. I think that that's, you know, one of the reasons why I've cut so many. But then, you know, if I need to kind of bridge that gap a little bit, you can sing love songs about tequila.
Oh, no, somebody just bought a shot of that Patron. Hang on, I just might have to stay.
Chris Young now has his sixth number one single, the title track from his new CD, I'm Coming Over. The singer says that he believes that he is drawing from a long history in country music.
You know, falling in love with somebody or you know, really just seeing somebody for the first time and having that passionate connection with them, that's something that everybody can relate to regardless of, you know, whether it's, you know, first love or if it's, you know, they've been married for 40, 50 years with somebody.
Chris Young plans to tour in support of the new album beginning in January. Cassidy Pope, who sings a duet with Chris on the new CD, will also be on the tour. Pope was the first female vocalist to win the Voice singing competition in 2012. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Indeed. Singer-songwriter Adele decided not to allow the streaming of her new album 25 when it's released today. Spotify or Apple Music, the streaming sites, say they're upset about it, but what can they do? But Apple site iTunes will be selling 25. It'll be on the market later today. You might remember that 21 did very well. Her last album, 11 million copies there. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great, great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Tunisia, where the Arab Spring was born, democratic progress continues. On a recent visit there, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "The eyes of the world are on Tunisia, and America wants Tunisia to succeed." Despite great hardships and two major terrorist attacks, Tunisia has turned time and again to peaceful dialogue, consensus building, and compromise. As a result, Tunisia has built a powerful front against the Islamic extremists who oppose freedom, democracy, and everything that the Tunisian people are striving to build. The United States is committed to helping Tunisia move forward on its economic, democratic, and security objectives. The United States has already provided more than $700 million in foreign assistance to Tunisia since 2011, in the form of direct aid to democracy building, assistance for elections and civil society organizations, and security support. That's why the United States supports Tunisia's ambitious economic reform agenda. The government has proposed specific reforms, which they have forwarded now to the parliament. In an effort to help Tunisia achieve its goals, the U.S. has signed a declaration of intent, signifying its readiness to grant a third loan guarantee to Tunisia. In order to protect Tunisia's emerging democracy and growing prosperity, it is essential to enhance security cooperation. Toward that end, President Barack Obama recently announced his intent to designate Tunisia a major non-NATO ally. The U.S. will continue to stand with Tunisia in addressing all terrorist threats. Indeed, the United States welcomes Tunisia's decision to join the global counter-ISIL coalition in September. The terrorists associated with ISIL need to know this. Their days are numbered, and they will be defeated. There is no future, no path forward for ISIL, which does not lead ultimately to its destruction. The United States is committed to standing with the Tunisian people, to deepening the growing partnership that both nations share, and to continuing to support Tunisia's democratic journey.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.